It's the only time you have control of Bob McCowan. Let's go. Subscribe to Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. Bob the Conqueror. Bob the Absolute. Bob the Infallible. Bob the Keeper of Pet Roosters. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Another Monday, another 50 cents. That's how we roll here. It's prime time on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks. McCown in the captain's chair, kicking ass, taking names. Brunt will be in here in an hour from now. Meanwhile, between this moment and the next, your telephone calls at 416-870-0590, star 590 on your cell, or toll-free across the country, 1-888-666-0590. They're toll-free, all of them. You don't have to pay a nickel. We do advise you to call in early, though. We're never happy when people call in and a little later in the program and aren't able to get on. We want everybody to get on, so we do advise you to assemble your comments or questions in advance, if at all possible. Later in the show, Clint Malarchuk will join us, former goaltender. He is the author of a new book called Saved, How I Survived My Life in Hockey. And if you know the Clint Malarchuk story, you will know what some of this book is about. It's some heavy-duty stuff. So I look forward to seeing him at in an hour and 15 minutes from now. Jim Houston of the NHL on Sportsnet. Don Cherry will join us later. And Rob Nyer of Fox Sports as we get set for the World Series, which finally will get going this week. So that's all ahead on today's program. But first, your telephone calls. Tell me where we should go first. Hit an arrow, hit a button, hit something. Let me know who we're talking to. To Kirk in Agincourt. You're first today. Hello.
Greetings, Bob.
Salutations.
I'm just wondering, I was reading in CFL Blitz in the Toronto Sun about a week ago, who, by the way, do a great job of covering the Canadian Football League. There's two things that they mentioned. They weren't elaborating on it, but since you're friends with both these gentlemen, it mentioned Pinball Clemens was in talks with MLS&E, and David Cinnamon's name has resurfaced in some capacity that they didn't elaborate. So I'm just wondering, do you know anything about that? I'll hang up and listen.
The answer is known on beyond what I've heard, which is what you've heard. These things are being mentioned. Michael is the vice chair of the board of the Toronto Argonauts, so he is still intimately connected to the franchise, and he has a spiritual connection to the franchise. It would not surprise me if Mike was looking around for partners to join him in salvaging the franchise. But I can't tell you more than that. It hasn't been shared with me. And David Cinnamon, I speak to on a fairly regular basis. He has never raised that topic, but I've never raised it with him. If there was any truth to the Cinnamon rumor, I hate to say I feel like I would know, but maybe I wouldn't. All I can tell you is I don't know anything about either possibility. I find it difficult to believe that a smart businessman like David Cinnamon would have an answer when there is to how you continue to run the Toronto Argonauts in the absence of a lease agreement long term with the Rogers Centre and no alternative apparent. I suppose, I guess there's the outside chance, you know, with the renovation of BMO, they agree to knock down one end zone. But if they were going to do that, would they? I've been told it's an extra $15 to $20 million to expand the footprint of BMO in order to accommodate the Canadian Football League. Do you think MLSE would go down that road simply to acquire a tenant? A tenant who would chew up your soccer field and make your TFC fans unhappy. A tenant who couldn't overpay for that right because of the economics of the Canadian Football League. And above and beyond all that, as much as David Cinnamon loves the Canadian Football League and loved owning the Toronto Argonauts, he came to the realization ultimately that there was no economic basis for success. If something has happened in the last couple of 3 years since he's been out to change his mind, I mean, he's a friend of mine. I see him socially on a semi-regular basis. I just think I would have heard something. He would have said something. So on a purely personal level, I can't deny the story, but I have a hard time believing it. Spike in Toronto, hello.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Fine.
I was trying to get through last week, but I called too late. Good thing you warned me today to call early.
Thank you.
I think the NBA should just expand their rosters with this new money coming in. It solves the minutes problem, the playoffs problem, and there's no required games to be cut off the schedule. No 11-minute quarters, no nothing. All the players still get a raise. It still gets the new money gets divided up between the players, the new players, and the league. Everybody's happy. I can't see what's wrong with that idea right there. I'll let you take over.
Well, here's the problem with that is even if you went to 11-minute quarters, which is the experiment, as has been pointed out previously by me and by others, you should not assume that an 11-minute quarter as opposed to a 12-minute quarter means that LeBron James will have less playing time. It means the guys off the bench will have less playing time. You know, athletes are conditioned to play a certain number of minutes, a certain amount of time. So it doesn't solve that problem. Similarly, expanding the roster from 12, the active roster from 12, just puts another couple of guys on the end of the bench you're never going to play. Your 11th and 12th guys only play in slop time. On some teams, your 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th guys only play in slop time, which is a blowout one way or the other, and usually only the last couple of minutes of a game. They'll get almost no other playing time, except if you run into a whole bunch of injuries, which can happen, but is still very rare. You know, in an ideal scenario, an NBA roster, you want it to be 10 deep. Your 11th and 12th guys, if you can squeeze a couple of minutes a game in for them, that's great. But more often than not, you're not going to be able to. Most teams aren't able to go 10 deep. Not in terms of real minutes. Most can go 9, a few maybe 8. Which is not to say that the other guys won't play. They're just playing, as I said, slop time. So adding two more to the roster doesn't change anything. The notion of playing fewer games is one that all players would endorse until you tell them what the economic impact of that's going to be. If you reduce the regular season by 10%, let's say you cut it back to 74 games theoretically from 82, which is approximately a 10% discount. Here's what you can expect. 10% less revenues from all sources, including television. Therefore, 10% fewer dollars for the players to divide. Now, if each NBA player is prepared to take a 10% salary cut, I mean, you could begin that conversation. But if I'm an owner, I'm also, because basically the pie is split 50-50, I have to agree to take a 10% revenue cut. And if I was an owner, I don't know why I'd do it. I get that it's a long season, but players aren't dropping dead. Injuries are always a concern, but is there an epidemic of injuries among highly skilled basketball players? And even when you get somebody like a Kobe Bryant out for an extended period of time, do ticket sales, are they adversely impacted? I think you'd have to show me that documentation. The net result is it's an interesting little experiment, but I don't think it goes anywhere. Victor in Milton, hello.
Good afternoon, Bob. First, let me say I don't hesitate in bringing up racial topics on your show because you usually handle them pretty thoughtfully. Here's one that I just turned on the radio this morning, and I believe this gentleman was a curator of the Negro Leagues in Kansas City, and he made the most interesting comment. He said Kansas City is playing Negro League baseball. And, I started to think about it, and I'm thinking, Negro League baseball, what does that mean exactly? They steal a lot of bases. They're pretty athletic, so on and so forth. But here's the thing. I looked up stolen bases, the top 25 players of all time, and sure enough, 19 of them are black, and the other six, three of them are pre-Jackie Robinson, the other three, and believe it, Paul Molitor and Brett Butler, and I can't remember the other guy. So the question that I have, and you can comment on that statement as well, is it analytics that have taken stolen bases out of baseball or philosophy, or is it maybe something else? Thanks, Bob. I'll let you comment on that. Thanks.
Thanks. That's an interesting question. I don't pretend to have the answer off the top of my head. There are fewer African Americans playing the game today than, probably going back to the 60s, I would say, at least, maybe before that. And I don't have any numbers off the top of my head to demonstrate exactly how many African-Americans were playing in the 1960s. But if you assume that by whatever point you think the game was fully integrated, I mean, it started with Jackie Robinson in 47, Larry Doby 48. If you assume by the early 60s the game was fully integrated, the percentage of African-American players in the game is as low as it's been since then. I haven't seen a recent number, but about a year and a half ago, I think it was, I want to say 7%, 8.3% going into this season. That's alarmingly low when one compares to the National Football League or the NBA, for example. And there has been a fundamental shift in the interest, the sporting interest, and pursuit of African-American athletes. I'm somebody who has long believed that regardless of the color of your skin, if you're an athlete, if you are channeled into a particular sport early in life, you will have the same chance of success within reason as you would have had if you were channeled into any other sport. I understand that there's some variable in here because there are differences in the skill sets. I mean, I understand that if you're 5'10" and athletically inclined, you have limitations. You're not likely to be an NBA player, but you're probably not likely to be only slightly more likely to be an NFL player, and probably only slightly more likely than that to be a baseball player. And again, most athletes these days are channeled into sports at a very young age before they're completely mature. So how do you take a look at a 7 or 8 or 9 year old kid and know how tall he's going to be? Or what his body type will be? What you do know is if you are athletically inclined, generally speaking, your abilities, your athletic abilities allow you to play almost any sport at a higher level than somebody who's not. You know, why are so many athletes good golfers? It's a perfect example. Hand-eye coordination, which is necessary in the game of golf. is generally a fundamental skill set of somebody who's a good athlete. So what's happened here is African-American athletes have gravitated towards basketball and football. Maybe for cultural reasons. I don't pretend to know. But it would be nice if more of them took the baseball route. There is one fundamental difference that's worth pointing out, and I don't pretend to be a sociologist or have any knowledge of whether this is a real factor or not. But we all do know that the route to Major League Baseball generally goes through many years in the minor leagues. Even those athletes who go to college, go to a four-year college and stay there, tend to wind up spending at least a couple of years in the minors. You'd have to think that the average age of a baseball player getting to the major leagues is probably around 23 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood. So compare that to other sports. Football player, you know, 3 years of university, 3 years of college, you're in at 18, you're out at 21, you're in the National Football League at 21. You're a basketball player, 1 year in college, you're 19, you're in the NBA. You want to be a baseball player? You're not going to start getting paid serious money until you're 23 or older. Is that a reason? I don't know. But it's a fact. And it probably plays a role. Warren, Mississauga, hello.
Good afternoon, Bob. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to go back to that first caller you had and his comment or your comment that would look about $15 million to upgrade BMO if MLSC was interested in taking a part of that. And if you were saying it might be hard to justify that expenditure, I'm a big Detroit Red Wings fan. And looking back over the weekend, you know, how the Leafs can spend that money in two seasons on Phaneuf. And just between the two organizations, you look at the way the Wings are intimately involved in the city of Detroit. Maybe if MLSC wanted to do the same with the Canadian Football League and help out getting that rolling in the right way again, I kind of think it would be worth that expenditure, especially when you compare how much money they make and where they're absolutely wasting it now, in my opinion, on that clown Phaneuf.
I'm missing your point here. What are you proposing they do?
That they actually do dig in and get involved with the CFL.
Well, I mean, there's a but. Look, they kicked the tires at it recently. MLSE was allegedly about to announce the purchase of the Toronto Argonauts. And we reported here, I mean, I could look up the date, I don't remember it exactly, but I want to say midsummer, early summer, that the deal fell through. That they had second thoughts. And the reason they have second thoughts is pretty obvious. There is no evidence to suggest that you can make the Toronto Argonauts a profitable entity. There's no evidence to suggest you can break even. The only evidence is you will lose money. And your only chance of recovering some, but not all of that, is intermittently being given a Grey Cup game, which is another load and another responsibility heaped upon you. Because you have to buy that right from the league. Now, you can make money off it. Will it recover 1 year's losses, 2 years' losses? That's possible. But you can't get enough Grey Cup. Unless you had the Grey Cup game in Toronto every other year, it's difficult to see how you could make money at it. Now, how do you increase a fan base? You know, I've gone down this road a zillion times, a zillion ways, and I can't find the answer. Good people have owned this franchise. dedicated people, smart people, and have been unable to turn a profit on this franchise. I think MLSE took a look at it and said, it's nothing more than a loss leader. If it helps you get an NFL team, maybe you pursue it. But absent that, why would you do it? Which is why I understand pinball, because he has the passion. I don't understand the suggestion of David Sinnemann getting back in. Maybe I'm missing something. David's a very wealthy guy. Maybe David feels that he can afford to take those losses. But he certainly got tired of it a few years ago when Mr. Braley wound up stepping in for Sinnemann and Sokolowski. So from an economic standpoint, I don't see how MLSE spends the money to increase the size of their stadium. I think it potentially hurts their relationship with their soccer fans and doesn't create an environment that is conducive to making the Toronto Argonauts profitable in and of its own. So I'm kind of lost on what the deal would be and how it would work. One more before the break. Greg, Saskatoon, hello.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Excellent.
Bob, I'm just calling about Neil Yakupov and the Edmonton Oilers.
Yep.
I heard a rumor that Neil is on his way to Columbus or New Jersey or the Islanders. And I've heard from a fairly reliable source that the guys don't get along with them. And I just wanted to get your view on that.
I have no idea. I can't help you with him from any of those perspectives. I haven't heard any of those rumbles, and I don't pay that much attention to it.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's like in the room. You hear a lot of things. I dismiss them unless I have first-hand information, and I don't have that. I think it makes sense. I've said it repeatedly that Edmonton at some point is going to have to move one or more of these young players in order to bring in sufficient stability to allow the others to succeed. Because as a collective, this team is not working. This group, by now, should have shown tangible upward signs that they are headed in the right direction. And I, for one, and I think Edmonton fans in general, aren't seeing those signs. It's not that individually all these high draft choices aren't skilled players, that they aren't assets. But as a collective right now, I don't know what they need. Is it just better goaltending? Do they need a better defense? Do they need a veteran up front to help them? I can't tell you the answer to those questions. Nobody knows for sure, but they need something. I think what's clear is this collective, this group, can't win as they are constructed. And the only way to make tangible change is to sacrifice one or two or maybe more of these highly thought of good young players. And Yakupov certainly would fit that bill. We'll take the break. When we come back, I got some numbers here. Very interesting numbers on African Americans in Major League Baseball. We'll share them with you. And it illustrates very clearly what we were talking about earlier. That and more of your phone calls when we come back on Primetime. This is the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.
Now, Primetime is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Before the Aaron McCowan on the radio program. Earlier, I had a caller ask about African-Americans and baseball. And I have the statistical data in front of me. since 1947 when the color barrier was broken by Jackie Robinson in the National League. And there was a fairly steady rise in the percentage of African Americans playing the game right through to 1972-73 when it started to level off. And it leveled off in around 17-plus percent. So almost one in five players in Major League Baseball was African American. Now, keep in mind that another 10 or 11% were Latino. So that's in addition to. So these are non-white players is really essentially what we're talking about. But let's stick with the African Americans because we understand that the Latino percentage has continued to go up. In 1973, 17.4% of all players in Major League Baseball were African American. 11% were Latino. By 1994, so approximately 20 years later, the percentage of African Americans was virtually unchanged, 17.2%. Latinos are up to 17.8%. Now let me give you the numbers for today. And most recently, this is up until 2012. In 2012, the number of Latinos had risen to 26.9%. So approximately one in four major league players was Latino. African Americans, 7.2. The decline has been pretty steady and pretty consistent since 1994. 17.2% down to 16.1, down to 16, down to 15, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now we sit at around 7.2. Now this is 2012. I don't know why I don't have numbers for the last 2 years, but this is the list that we have. So you can see that there is something going on here. At the same time, and while I don't have those numbers in front of me, I think we would all understand that the numbers have risen for the NBA and the National Football League. So there definitely has been a cultural gravitational movement to those two sports and away from baseball. And, I acknowledge there are probably numerous reasons for that move, but it is real, and it is something that Major League Baseball is already trying to address, principally with inner-city programs, baseball programs. And yet, you can say economics play a role, but baseball is not an expensive game to play. Parks generally are available. As a general rule, you pay a nominal amount, if anything, as a baseball team, to play on a diamond. You don't pay anywhere near what you would pay to rent a gymnasium or to rent a football field. While the cost of equipment generally in the schools is borne by the schools themselves, and that mitigates the cost for athletes, there are still expenses that come with playing football outside of the school system. So, economics don't seem to me to play a significant role. I think it's popularity. And I think that football stars and basketball stars are bigger stars than baseball stars. And I'm not sure I know how you turn that around. Back to the phone calls. Eric in Englehart, is that right?
That's right.
Hi.
Hey. I just want to get your feelings on the Montreal Canadiens, and in particular, Alex Galchenyuk and P.K. Subban.
Why particularly them?
Just looks like those two are going to have monster campaigns this season.
Two very good young hockey players playing on a team that is... let me say this. I'm surprised... Every time I look at the Canadiens over the last couple of years and see how well they play, how many wins they accumulate. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time relating that to the roster I see in front of me. In other words, I can take a look. You and I could take a look at the Anaheim Ducks, for example, and we see the star players that they have on their team and the quality and depth of talent that they have on their team, and you understand why they're where they are. And the same thing with the LA Kings and the and even San Jose, although they, you know, they spit up the bit in the playoffs every year. The Boston Bruins. You can take a look at the star players on the Boston Bruins, the key players on that team, and you can understand why they're a perennial contender. I always have a hard time with Montreal.
Maybe it's that way too now, though.
I'm sorry?
Maybe you have to look at them that way as well.
I think you probably do. Maybe, you know, we're getting to the point where we're starting to recognize that that group actually does, these players who I thought were kind of just okay guys are better than okay.
Yeah.
But they are, you know, they are absolutely a very good team, which I think is an interesting model. We think of good teams as always having star players and a number of star players. And sometimes those star players make the team good. Sometimes those players playing on a good team become stars. As a function of playing on a good team. The Montreal Canadiens are maybe the latter. Maybe as they continue to move, you know, over the next few years, perhaps up the standings and towards the Stanley Cup, I and others will have a greater appreciation for the quality of the skill set of their best players. But as a team, they're very, very good. I didn't expect, absent significant moves, I didn't expect this core group to achieve the success that they have and be and achieve it on a consistent level the way they have. It's an interesting and somewhat unique situation. Scott Hamilton, hello.
Greetings, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask about maybe a change in management at Edmonton. It seems they've had a hard time drawing any sort of marquee free agent since Pronger. And when they had him, they made it to Game 7 of the Cup Final. And they haven't really done anything since. I love Cates, but I think he's sort of attached to the old boys club of Kevin Lowe and McTavish, et cetera. And wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, if they maybe change the president, change the GM, shake up the whole front office, if they might have.
Well, I think it still comes down to the same thing. Whoever you replace them with, if that's your agenda, I think they're going to be faced with the same reality that at some point you're going to have to cut bait with some of these kids.
Sure.
If you're an Edmonton fan and you think I'm wrong that staying the course is the right idea for another year or 2 years. Okay.
It's hard to be a fan right now.
It's hard, but it's hard to look at that group and say there's still more there. There's potential there. They will get better. That, you know, eventually they will congeal, that this group will come together and this group of this bunch of individuals as a collective can be among the best in the National Hockey League. I don't see that anymore. I think you could see that 2 or 3 years ago,
sure.
But then you had a whole bunch of kids who were 19 and 20 years old, and you know you really couldn't expect too much from them.
Yeah, and I really like to see Dallas Aiken succeed there, but it seems to be a little bit of a struggle at this point.
Well, and again, how many times do you change the head coach? And I'm not adverse to the notion of changing management. I mean, I understand your frustration, and I understand that it's a logical thing to do. I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but you don't just want to shuffle the deck chairs here. If you're going to bring new management in, it's because this management is stubbornly hanging on to these guys when it's clear that you have to move some of them. And so you bring in new management who will do that. It's not necessary to bring in new management. I think it's necessary to make change. Who does it is irrelevant to me. And should be irrelevant to most fans. Adam, Niagara Falls. Hello.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing?
Okay.
I just want to talk about the Leafs and the defensive struggles that they've had. But if you think about it, and you've seen the way they've played, they haven't been as bad as they were last year.
Defensively?
Defensively.
The sample size is way too small still. I can't evaluate. I mean, do I like this group of defensemen? There are things about it that I like. It still comes down to a couple of very key points. You've got to keep shots on goal down, and they've only intermittently been able to do that. And you've got to have more puck possession time, and they've only barely done better at that. So
also,
yeah,
I also want to have your take on the Komarov, Clarkson, and Santorelli line.
Yeah, do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I think they've played great. I think they've kept the puck well, and they've cycled the puck well. And
yeah, they're all right, you know. I mean, again, I don't have great expectations from a third or fourth line. I really don't. I mean, I think what you want is you want them to hold their own and chip in with an occasional goal, and they've done that. The notion that Clarkson, you know, not to pick on him, and the Leafs offered him a contract, then he took it. But the notion that Clarkson is a $5 million or whatever he's being paid hockey player is pretty eye-opening to me. I mean, I don't know what your level of expectation is, but mine's higher for a $5 million player. And I've said repeatedly that this is where NHL teams screw themselves. It's not with the guys at the top of the food chain, and it's not with the guys at the bottom of the food chain. The guys at the top, I mean, you can't make mistakes there. I mean, I wouldn't have paid Phaneuf what they're paying them. But as a general rule, your mistakes are made in the middle area, $3, $4, $5 million. And more often than not, you know, a $3, $4, $5 million guy, if I'm going to pay him that kind of money, I expect him at someday to be a $7 or $8 million player. Now, you take a look at the guys who are making that kind of money and historically have made that kind of money, middle money, you know, or one tier below the premier player on the Toronto Maple Leafs. And how many of those guys have gone on to become $7 or $8 million players? How many guys have gone on and signed contracts that were greater than the contract they signed with the Toronto Maple Leafs? And if it's not a significant number, then you know that mistakes have been made. And I don't think you even have to do the math to know that mistakes have been made. Paying too much for mediocre skill set that can't possibly give you a return. And even though Clarkson seems to have played better in the short term this year, he fit into that category. What, did he score 5 goals last year? I know he missed time. You can't pay a guy $1 million a goal. You can't do that. I understand he theoretically gives you other things, but those intangibles have to be viewed as bonuses, not as an integral part of the investment. Matt, Orangeville, hello.
Hey, Bob. I'm just wondering, with the MLB postseason seeming to be such a crapshoot, I don't know if it's just me. It seems like with the MLB, more than any other league, in the postseason, anything can happen. I'm wondering if there's ever a chance that they're going to change the format, maybe have the first round be a full 7-game series, or even add an extra round or an extra series.
The only thing I don't like is I don't like the 1-game play-in. I'd like to see it 2 out of 3, but it does mess things up a little bit. I've also proposed, and I did some math on it years ago. I said, you know, go to a 156-game schedule, which basically eliminates the last week of the season. So if you go to 156, now you get into the immediately people say, oh, well, they won't do that because you're chopping a week's worth of revenue off. No, you're replacing that week's worth of revenue with different revenue. Higher revenue, fewer games, but higher revenue games. So you allow maybe another couple of teams into the postseason and create an additional round of playoffs, even if it's best 2 out of 3. But probably you could do 3 out of 5 in that extra week. And I submit to you that the revenue would be significantly higher overall. The take the ballparks would be I mean, there'd be fewer parks in use, but they'd be full at a ticket price that's several times what the regular season ticket price would be. You'd have more teams playing meaningful games in September, which means that you'd have bigger attendance going down the stretch. So additional revenues would be generated there. Television networks will pay more for postseason baseball than they will for regular season baseball, so you'd increase the pie there. So if you look at all the revenue streams that are potentially generated, as a collective, there's at least as much money, maybe more money, maybe significantly more money in a 156-game schedule with another layer of playoffs. I don't like the idea of playing 162 and then having to play one game to decide whether you're in or out. I understand the drama. I get that. But a best of two, or better than that, a best three out of five, where all teams participate in the first round, nobody gets a bye, makes a lot more sense to me. And as we've seen in all sport, regular season success does not necessarily equate to success in the postseason. More often than not, it does. There are anomalies like this year where you get, you know, a couple of play-in teams, wild card teams, wind up in the post in the championship game. It doesn't happen as often as you think. I don't think there's a need to change the format for that reason. But I do think more postseason, less regular season, there's an economic reality to that. And from a fan interest, a pure fan interest, how do you lose? We got time to squeeze one more in. Mike in Mississauga, hello.
Hey, Bob, got pleasure to speak to you.
You got about 60 seconds, shoot.
Oh, I'll be fast. When I heard you making the comment about the cost of playing, you know, kids playing football and basketball as compared to baseball, I was thinking, I think you're overlooking something about the cost there. Kids must see in the States, I believe, have an easier time at looking at it as a sport, both sports. You do it through essentially making the pros through high school, right?
That's right. Yeah.
College system, right?
Yep.
So maybe they see it, and baseball, in terms of a cost there, the kids playing that on the streets, I still think there's a, I mean, you need a glove. I mean, when you're thinking of inner city and stuff, it's not like basketball. You pick up a ball. One guy has a ball. You show up. Everybody plays.
Yeah, I guess you're right. On the schoolyard, that's true. But, I mean, once you get into competitive situations, there's gyms to rent, you know, and if you're looking at AAU and stuff like that, you know, there are inherent costs. I mean, it's sort of like saying, I understand your point, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but it is sort of like saying ball hockey and ice hockey are exactly the same thing. You know, you can just pick up your stick and grab a tennis ball and go out in the street, and it doesn't really cost you anything. But if you put on a pair of skates and you want to go find a piece of ice, it's going to cost you a couple $100 for an hour to rent that ice. So,
yeah.
I know you have more to say, but as I told you, you only have 60 seconds. We're pretty much out of time. I hate to cut you off, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. And look, I'm not pretending that it's a perfect science. I think my first argument in terms of why African-American kids have gone away from baseball, it is cultural. The biggest stars to them are football stars and basketball stars. You go to a high school, the kids who are looked up to are the football and basketball players. Baseball player, not much notoriety. You don't see high school baseball on television much. You don't see college baseball on television much. Basketball and football, all the time. Lots of it. Big revenue-generating sports. Big notoriety. And the ability to start generating revenue if you're good enough. And even though a small percentage of these kids will ever be good enough, they aspire to it. If you're going to chase the athletic dream, if you're a black kid in America, basketball and football are 1 and 1A. Baseball is way down the list. More primetime coming up.